Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa. Hi everyone, my name's Sean Bresnan, and thanks for listening to the first of many podcasts with author Peter Moon. These podcasts will explain, discuss, and dissect the many subjects which Peter has written about in his books. A few weeks ago, I had just finished reading a book by Ingo Swann on a remote viewing. I wanted to learn more about it, I did some searches, and Google led me to Peter. Peter, what can you tell us about remote viewing?
Remote viewing is a subject that really began to capture the public's imagination after the first book I co-authored and published, The Montauk Experiments in Time, was published in 1992. And that got a lot of, because that book included the history of an experiment at Montauk Point, Long Island, at the old Montauk Air Force Station, where a subject by the name of Duncan Cameron was, his mind and his psychic powers, his mental powers were amplified through radio frequency transmissions out to the general populace. And these were the culmination of a lot of subsidiary experiments or empirical experiments that had been done leading up to this. The end project of these was not only to make people's moods change, but also to eventually manipulate matter, energy, space, and time. And this is the general thesis of the Montauk Project book by Preston Nichols and myself, Peter Moon, The Montauk Project Experiments in Time. Duncan Cameron, as I said, was the lead psychic and perpetrator of this attempt. Now, after that book was published, you had people coming out of the woodwork to talk about remote viewing. This, and remote viewing camps became public or semi-public. Remote viewing camps in the military, people were going to them. But there's a whole other sinister side to these remote viewing camps and whatnot.
Right.
It's all that, and I noticed it as a published author, how I noticed a lot of it was not only taking attention off of the work and the issues that I had brought up, but was kind of redirecting them and misdirecting people to where you had people thinking, oh, I'm going to be a remote viewer, I'm going to be a remote viewer, and this sort of thing, and then you had people making a tremendous amount of money off of it, selling it, and delivering no real, tangible results.
Right. What were they remote viewing?
Go ahead.
What were they remote viewing?
Well, if you're talking about the Latter-day people or the Montauk people.
The Montauk people.
That's like asking, what was the Vatican? Who was the Vatican looking into, and what were they doing?
Oh,
you can believe
I didn't realize
that
it was Vatican, that
big. If the Vatican, when they did their Inquisitions, what they were looking for in the days of the Vatican, or the Inquisitions, I should say.
Right.
The Vatican is still present. They were looking for assets. They were looking for power, and they would see who had money and who would be, you know, quantifiable and qualifiable heretics.
Yeah.
They could access the power that they had in terms of money. And this is the same thing that's going to be occurring at Montauk, only they're going to be using whatever psychic knowledge or powers they can access for their own selfish interests. So when you get to the remote viewing arena, you're dealing with power, you're dealing with emotion, and you're actually dealing with too little of the remote viewing itself. Because if one can determine where the gold deposit is and knows where the gold deposit is, then you're going to have to be dealing with the forces and counterforces that want to get at that gold, and that you're dealing with elementals, the guardians of the actual facility, and those guardians could appear as raw elemental energy. They could also appear as people in uniforms, people that are, or spirits that are illusory, like the old Men in Black paradigm. So you're dealing with guardians, and this becomes, so really when you begin to remote view, and you might have some varying degree of success, you might see the number of the player who is going to, you know, score the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl. That's really prognostication, not remote viewing. You're remote viewing into the future in that case. But you're not necessarily going to walk away with the whole ball of wax, because you have other people also competing with you, if you're even successful. So the issue is really not so much about remote viewing as it is about power. And this brings us into the scenario of global politics and what is behind global politics. But because I write about the esoteric aspects and the occult aspects of existence, there's also occult forces behind these. And the Montauk Project was primarily an occult force. And this is where the foundations of it were in occultism, mixing it with science, mixing it with psychology, mixing it with manipulation and abusive manipulation.
Okay.
Of the human psyche.
Wow, that's just all so fascinating. You know, to me, I often wonder if, you know, these Men in Black even exist, but listening to you talk about it and say they are out there, it's fascinating.
They're mental, spiritual, which is the same as saying illusory phenomena.
Right.
Doesn't mean they have corporeal existence. Doesn't mean they even exist at all in a physical sense. We just know that thousands upon thousands of witnesses, or reports of thousands upon witnesses having witnessed Men in Black.
Right.
I have seen them myself, but in the dream states.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps I've seen them in reality, but I couldn't wholeheartedly say they were Men in Black. They just smacked of it.
Right.
Other people, yes. But getting to the core of, you know, your interest in remote viewing, and you are reading a book by Ingo Swann.
Yes.
Now, very important to recognize Ingo Swann, and who's recently passed away, because Ingo Swann was known as the father of remote viewing.
Right.
And Ingo, I first learned of Ingo Swann when I was a Scientologist. And he was doing experiments at the Stanford Research Institute, where he was able to actually move a magnetometer or have an effect upon it that was buried deep below the surface of the Earth. And his remote viewing ability was recognized by scientists, and he was in league with another remote viewer named Pat Price. And the third one might be the most famous of them all. I can't remember his name at the moment. But these three were all Scientologists, and they were then advocates and practitioners of the upper levels of Scientology, which when I first heard of Ingo Swann, I was not a practitioner or participant. I did not have access to those upper levels, which have now become the object of extreme and sometimes hilarious ridicule.
Yeah.
On the internet. But you have to understand the first sort of public iteration of these did not come through the materials themselves or the ludicrousness, but the actual accomplishments of these three individuals. Now, Pat Price passed away under very dubious circumstances. He seemed to be the most talented of them all. I apologize for not being able to remember the third one, who was the most, I guess, seemed to be most active in the secret government. From what and where did he draw the line? He didn't stick around Scientology for way too long. But key individual that I believe involved at least with the Palo Alto crowd would have been Phil Spickler, who was the father of Mimi Rogers, who married Tom Cruise. Phil
right.
Spickler was a very accomplished Scientologist. He was very well trained. He had a very good demeanor, personality. He's still alive, to my knowledge, and he might have some interesting clues about the Stanford Research Institute and what those characters were doing, because he was right there in Palo Alto, and I believe he might have had something, some connections to that, or would know about the connections at the very least, I would imagine. He also got John Brody, the famous quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers, into Scientology. And as I say, when I became involved in Scientology in 1971, I was reading the San Francisco Chronicles, what do they call it? The Green Page. It was the Green Page that had all the sports and finance in it, and right there on the front page, Sporting Green, they called it. And they had, wow, John Brody, MVP. You know, the secret behind his success was Scientology, a whole article on how this really incredible quarterback with a really incredible strong arm could never throw, he couldn't throw the ball anymore. It was too much of a sore arm. So he met Phil Spickler, and Phil talked to him and got him to regress into past lives where he was able to see where the pain was coming from. It was coming from psychosomatic trauma. His arm straightened out. He came back the next year and became the MVP of the National Football League. So that was kind of, when I was getting to Scientology, these things were happening. And although it's not, there were a lot of the key happenings were in Davis, California, where I live.
Right.
And Palo Alto, which was the Phil Spickler's center there. It might have been Menlo Park, I think, if I recall properly. So there was a lot happening there in the Bay Area, and this was during the hippie era had not faded out at that time. Most of the kids were involved with drugs, and of course the rock and roll that was pervasive in the Bay Area with people know the Grateful Dead and then Jefferson Airplane, Santana,
right, Haight Ashbury.
Yeah, Quicksilver Messenger Service, all of which was the headliner band of the time, not the more famous ones. They did not, their notoriety did not stick with them. So, anyway, that's sort of a background to how I first learned about remote viewing capabilities, and it was through Scientology, And as they say, this is a subject which is just has extreme ridicule, and I can't say that it's not deserved. But when we go back into time, sometimes we have to measure history by what has been lost, as opposed to what has been gained. I mean, you know, we gain things, but what have we lost? And on that subject of remote viewing, which you were initially interested in, I could tell you from my experience in dealing with Scientology and the phenomena that elicited the remote viewing, which was, I had experienced it myself, I must say. But what it is, the whole idea of Scientology is that one has a mind that is not perfect, is not cluttered, that it is cluttered.
Right.
And the first object, and I'm putting this in very simple, straightforward terms, because if one complicates it, it becomes complicated and it will forever be complicated. But there were many definitions and experiences of the phenomena that Hubbard, L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, called clear. Now, it's important to remember that I had a great deal of personal access to L. Ron Hubbard's thoughts, opinions, personality, etc., because I worked in his personal office. And I had a lot of experience, and we could say insight as well, into this man that a lot of his public or people or fans did not have. And you know, he certainly wasn't perfect. And interestingly enough, it was one of my jobs is to not let people get carried away with thinking he was her. And that was actually one of the functions of my job was that this is an ordinary human being. Well, he wasn't ordinary, but you know, I mean,
right.
He slept 8 hours a day, et cetera, et cetera. Because people would think that he was far more powerful and intelligent than he actually was. But anyway, he was highly intelligent and he was powerful. But more to the point was this whole idea of clearing the mind. Clearing the mind, many definitions of what they call the clear, but the one that's workable and the one that's easiest to work with is what is to come up with correct answers. A clear mind can come up with a correct answer. If you have an unclear mind, it's going to come up with an incorrect answer. And he used the analogy of an adding machine. If you hold down one of the keys, like a 7, it will continually give you wrong answers. So you have to have a clear adding machine in your head. Now, if the data you're given is wrong, that clear mind isn't going to help you.
Right. Well, that almost seems like a common sense kind of thing, doesn't it?
It's common sense, yes. If you can maintain common sense and be fully present of common sense, which was another tenet that he used, was the concept of being there, occupying the space that's in front of you. That includes occupying your own mental space and not having somebody else occupy it.
Understand that difference.
Well, yes. So occupying one's space is occupying one's mind, being one's mind, being in charge of one's mind, as opposed to answering based upon your fear of somebody or something or giving the wrong answer.
Oh,
like,
okay.
When people work around a dictator, they'll do anything he wants. They'll laugh at anything he says. And, of course...
And famous people.
Exactly, like you're trying to please. No, a correct answer is a correct answer. And this is the whole idea, and I'm going to get back to your subject on remote viewing, is to have a clear mind.
Right.
And having a clear mind is a whole approach to how do you have a clear mind. And they had procedures and techniques directed towards achieving that. Of course, I had some degree of success in achieving that for myself. And at least, and the ultimate judge is yourself. Was your mind cleared? Well, I had a lot of incorrect answers and incorrect predispositions by reason of growing up the way I did, which was, I guess, mostly average. But, you know, there's things that you're not taught, you don't learn, and I was able to go in and reinspect maybe some of the more incorrect orientations that I might have been taught in life, either through my parents or more often the society. And, well, I'm not going to carry those answers with me forward. But the whole idea of having a clear mind and getting to remote viewing is another challenge, because you have mechanisms in the mind which are general. And these general mechanisms in the mind have to do with one's predisposition towards life and what upsets people in life, what affects them in life. And these were... one's ability certainly to communicate, and upsets concerning communication, and processing the whole subject of communication, like, wow, some people can't communicate, some people can't talk, and what are the psychological reasons behind why people can't talk? And they just sit there and kind of growl at you and don't resolve issues, the strong silent type, or people that are too emotional and don't talk, or not emotional enough. So communicating and upsets around communicating and getting the energy to flow inside one's head, getting it to flow inside one's head between oneself and another. And then there are problems. What are problems? People have problems all the time. Well, one has to address and process the subject of problems. Then there's the other part of this is what we have to do is guilt and things associated with guilt. Actions you should not do or actions you do that you should not. Well, it's really the same thing, what I just said.
Right.
But, or omissions that you should do and you don't. So basically, you have a realm where people have committed crimes, misdemeanors, or some shades of gray or black concerning those two topics. And these become a malefic influence on one's life. And then the whole psychological attitudes and affectations that go with them. So you can have people that are afraid that they're going to be mean to people, or they're not afraid to be mean to people. And you can have this whole realm where the mind becomes based upon greed, avarice, and other unsultry type of behavior. So one has to clear out one's mind of one's own misdeeds, and also clear out one's minds of what others have done to them, and just what others doing to others. Because you can watch it, all the crimes being perpetrated on people, all you have to do is watch the news. And this can be psychologically disturbing to people. You see it all the time, people posting on Facebook and saying, oh, so-and-so is doing this to such-and-such. Blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Well, it's true. They are doing such and such. And people get irate about it. They get too emotional about it. And it can affect them having a clear mind. In other words, they can't come up with correct answers because they're too obsessed or preoccupied with what they're doing to some indigenous people somewhere. And it's, no, they shouldn't do it. It's okay to protest about it, but people can get caught up, and it can affect their own emotions to the detriment of their own lives. And so basically, these are three very simplistic avenues: the realm of guilt, the realm of problems, the realm of communications and upsets around communication. And I'm oversimplifying this. And there's also another one that has to do, and this is from a Scientology perspective, and what was the foundational elements of what was the precursor to the levels that could either deliver or pledge to deliver or might deliver the remote viewing capabilities. And the other aspect, and they called all of these rudiments, they were rudimentary to having a foundation of a clear mind. And the other one I was going to say was the tendency to make others wrong, or to be made wrong, or to feel that you've made wrong, and to give somebody a hard time. But it's a preoccupational or habitual attitude. Like, say, if you tell somebody that there's no Illuminati, oh, there's no Illuminati, there's no Illuminati, there's no secret societies, you can do it as a continual make wrong of the idea. On the other hand, you can say something, yeah, that's all the Illuminati, everything's the Illuminati, everything's the Illuminati, and then it becomes, you know,
it's like a reflex.
Yeah, it's a make right of their attitude, and they're making others wrong because the Illuminati is the answer to everything, when both attitudes are, you know, quite clearly.
One thing you said to me in one of the first emails that we wrote to each other, you said that belief is a trick. And I love that statement.
Well, that's another foundational experience that I had before I ever got into Scientology. But it was also a foundational experience in Scientology if you study the materials the way I did, which was belief is just belief. It's like what you want is knowledge, to know in the deepest sense of the word. And that's
where I find myself growing towards now.
That's the core. Now, that's the core, and this is the subject, really, of epistemology. And
what's that?
Epistemology, good word. You know, and Hubbard described this in his books. I think he even lectured about it somewhat. And it's when I first heard the subject, epistemology, it's the study of the nature of knowledge, knowledge and the nature of knowledge.
Wow.
And also ontology, he mentioned, which is the study of the nature of being. These are two concepts that are actually taught in some university somewhere, or were at some point. It's not like somebody's going to go major in ontology or epistemology. It's the study of the very nature of knowledge. You're not just studying knowledge. Like you can say, the Romans built the Appian Way and to unite all of Rome. That was their main road in the Roman Empire. But, okay, that's a piece of knowledge and it's a piece of history. But there's other knowledge in the Roman Empire or attributed to the Roman Empire and the Greek civilization, which where they actually are going into deeper aspects of consciousness. So what is the nature of knowledge? And you have to embrace consciousness and you have to go deeply, very philosophical. And of course, what I would tell anybody is whatever system you're using, whether it be Scientology, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, you are the one who has to go in and do the work. The data that you befriend or accompany or read is only there as a crutch to get you to be able to walk in the field of experience and knowledge and experience. Experience is experience. It might come in different forms. It might be ethereal. It might be quite concrete, but it's experience.
Right.
And knowledge and experience go together.
You also said to take in all information as data to be proven right or wrong at a later date.
Yes, and that proof is going to be in your experience. It may be proof. I mean, we may be able to run look-in pass in a football game, and it might work on Tuesday, but it might not work, you know, Tuesday in practice, but it might not work on Sunday in the game, or vice versa. So some things, experience and knowledge are involved shades of gray. So it really comes down to, and Hubbard defined Scientology, he had different definitions for it, but one definition was knowing how to know. So knowing in the deepest, fullest sense of the word. So when you're, it doesn't matter if you're calling it Scientology or calling whatever it is. When you talk about this question you brought up about belief, well, if you want to believe in Jesus, or if you want to believe in Allah, or you want to believe in any other religion, that belief is something you tend, people tend to hold it up, and much like they're, it's almost like a postulate in a scientific experiment. You postulate that XYZ is true. You postulate that Jesus is the Savior and he's the Son of God. Well, it's hard to really do anything with that statement other than to postulate it and say this is the way it is because so-and-so told me or I read it such-and-such. But have you really examined why they told you and why you accepted it? It may well be true. And you will see some preachers or ministers and even those of the Catholic faith who will say, you must test your faith, you must test all this. So they're purporting, if not actually purporting to make your faith strong, go in and examine it, test it. And what are you really exhibiting in your faith? What are you really exhibiting to yourself in your own mental process? What is faith? Because in actual fact, we can't accept everything in a completely logical format. We can say that we wake up tomorrow and the earth is here. We're told all these things by science, that the earth is rotating, you know, every 24 hours it'll rotate, and then it's moving around the sun, and the sun is moving around the galaxy. We're taught these things by science, and they do tend to be true or appear to be true. But most of us are taking that information on what other people have said or what other scientists have said. And while much of it may well be true in a pragmatic sense, we are giving our power to let scientists decide for us unless we've gone in and done the science ourselves and really looked. And what are the limitations of those scientists? We have learned as a body populace that science has demonstrated a lot of, scientists have demonstrated a lot of shortcomings. So some things we accept on faith, like that we're going to wake up and the house is going to be there tomorrow, that the city's going to be there tomorrow, and that the planet's going to be there tomorrow. So a day-to-day sort of riding with the flow, going with the flow, is what we all experience. So when you go back to belief, one has to, the real key is examining what are one's own thoughts, what are one's own conclusions, and sometimes more importantly, what are the conclusions and thoughts of the people who are feeding you your information, and why did you accept that information from them, and why did they tell you? And this begins to open up a mind, open up to enlightenment, and this is why belief is has many shortcomings. If you can really turn it and work it into faith, it's still suspect, but it's less suspect. And if that faith can integrate with real intelligence and linear thinking, then the person exercising that faith, if he can integrate it with the logical and the intelligent, he's really accomplished something. And this is a very key element to religion, which is not really well understood by most religious people.
And well, I'm a recovering Catholic myself.
All right. So, anyway, these are all foundational elements of what I was saying that would theoretically opening you to the realm of what we're saying, remote viewing. And when I say the word theoretically, it's a very interesting word, because you have theo, which means God or the Dios, and you have rhetorically, rhetoric. Theoretically, it's the rhetoric of the Theos. It's the rhetoric of God.
Okay.
More specifically, the rhetoric of creation. So I'm giving you a creative meme, an idea. I'm saying, well, this is the, theoretically, it's an idea. It doesn't, it's just an idea. It's the rhetoric of an of creation. But I'm saying is, so these are the foundational elements of how the subject of remote viewing was approached in Scientology. It wasn't necessarily called remote viewing per se, but that was what so many people joined and so many people hoped to achieve there. And I learned over time...
I'm sorry, Peter. So people thought they could learn remote viewing by joining Scientology?
Well, apparently so. I mean, I didn't really... go in with that impetus. I was interested in, after I had read the first book one of Dianetics, The Modern Science of Mental Health, they wouldn't answer my questions. They said, read this book. So read book one, and then you can ask questions. And I read the book, and basically it talked about clearing the mind and using a therapy of counseling therapy called auditing, which means to go in and examine and basically to listen to somebody, and is to go in and clear out your own mind and to go into those parts or caverns of the mind which you were not aware of, that part of the consciousness of which most human beings are not aware of, going into the reservoir of unconscious. And that's what interested me. I said, well, I want to go in and examine my own mind. And that's exactly what I did do, and I was very happy with the results. I was so happy with the results that I dedicated my life to it for a period of really about 11 or 12 years. So, and I'm very happy with what I was able to accomplish while I was there. And I've learned over time that I seem to have accomplished a lot more than a lot of people who stayed on and, you know, they end up 20, 30 years of their life is in that organization, and they come out quite upset, feeling that they've been mistreated, cheated out of their life, and ultimately... You know, they have no one to, I guess, blame but themselves.
They had to pay to be in Scientology as well, didn't they?
Well, some of them did. Oh. Some of them didn't. That's a whole other story. But I'm going to stick to the concept of the remote viewing.
Oh, sorry.
Because that's originally what interested you in even, you know, getting into my work.
Yes.
So I'm talking to you a foundation. And any school, religious school you go to, whether it be you know, Tibetan Buddhists or whatnot, or even in certain aspects of Christian meditation techniques, you're put through exercises and training, and you know, you clear the mind out, and then you go to do things. Well, in Scientology, once one had a cleared mind, so to speak, and I've certainly shortcutted the whole procedures and concepts, but then one was going to extrovert one's attention and extrovert one's attention into more than just what was one's own mind. And that involves the collective unconscious. They didn't call it the collective unconscious. They had their own names, nomenclature.
Right.
And it's a disservice to even try to repeat them for an audience or for somebody who's not familiar or not even half familiar, because it only confuses the topic. I could talk with all that lingo, but it doesn't serve anybody at this point. So anyway, to exercise the mind, to have it have drills, procedures, or exercises which would not only exercise the ability to look out and extrovert into one's environment, rather than if one's not looking in their own mind, they're not introverted into their own mind, they're going to be looking out at what's out there, feeling the noosphere, feeling the atmosphere, feeling the ecosphere, but perceiving it and feeling it. These are the perceptics of thought. And then when you feel and you're on a different plane where you're not introverted into your own personal problems, what is out there? What is stopping humanity? What is stopping you? Scientologists were also fed the idea that they were immortal beings that could live, that did live forever, and would pick up a body, live body to body to body, which is not a new idea.
Right.
This goes back to Hinduism and other religions. This is not a new idea, but Scientologists tended to accept this or experience it. And I'd say from the many that I knew and lived with, it was a common reality that people did live before, and they would sometimes casually refer to it. Not necessarily obsessively.
How would they know?
Oh, it's, you know, how would you know? I will say this one time, and when I was in Scientology, I was jogging with this guy. We were jogging down the street in Clearwater, Florida. We're going by a mortician place. I think it was a Sunday, and we looked over, and the guy who came out, he was the assistant of the mortician.
Right.
He kind of bent over, and he, you know, he didn't look visually in the face like Igor from the movies.
Yeah.
But he was just like, man, wow. You could just see how this guy attracted this job of being a mortician, or of being a mortician's assistant.
Right.
He was kind of ghoulish, you know, and he would have fit in the Addams Family real well. And I just say, look at that. Well, wow. You know, we didn't have to say anything to each other. We just said, wow, look at what how he got that job.
Yeah. Like,
where did he come from? What was he in his last life? You could guess it or intuit it with a very thin margin of error. So you'd see situations like that with people or with things, and just kind of say, wow, that's kind of the culture that one lived in Scientology. But when one would extrovert into the environment, well, sooner or later, you're going to come up with ideas. More than ideas. You could come up with ideas, but things, phenomena that impinge upon one. And these stop the awareness, inhibit the awareness. And as I was speaking about the collective unconscious, Hubbard had a word that is an English word, but he used it to his own particularities, which was called implantation, whereby according to what he had discovered, is that ancient history was affected, deeply affected, by beings that would forcibly hurt or harm other beings. I say beings like spirits.
Okay.
For their own benefit. And they would implant their fellows, just sort of like the MKUltra program. MKUltra is where the government is involved in mind control. But in Scientology, Hubbard's theories were that this procedure of implanting people and controlling them was not recent. He was probably the first person to expose it on a cultural level and to point the finger at these people that were doing misuse of psychology, psychiatry, and implantation. MKUltra.
Huh.
He was exposing this. But his experience, thesis, idea, research, whatever you want to call it, was that this has been going on since time immemorial. And nobody's ever corrected. Nobody in the history of humanity. And he extended that to say the history of the entire galaxy universe. He said, I guess his attitude was, nobody's ever done this, nobody's ever talked about it. If they had, why haven't we, why are we still living in this dark ages? And this was an experience that he offered to people, or a theory, and people were very accepting of it because there's a lot of rationale and logic behind that idea. If you look at, you know, why hasn't humanity been better educated? What are the stoppages? Why do we have people being dumbed down in schools? Why do we have Monsanto? Why do we have genetic modification? Why do we have so much anti-life?
Right.
And he was creating a forum to say, bah. Now, at the same time, he was also taking advantage of it and saying, we're the only people who can fix this problem because we're the only ones that have ever brought it up. Now, that might be an arguable point, but it wasn't a very arguable point to those of us who grew up in the 60s and saw what society had to offer us, which wasn't too pleasant. And as bad as it was then, I think it's much more challenging in today's culture to grow up and to possibly be saddled with student debt that you can't get rid of, and you can't get a job to pay off the student debt. It's challenging to young children. And so basically, the argument he had was a very convincing argument. And it's a convincing argument today if I explain it in that context. Of course, I'm not trying to sell you on Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, or anything of the kind.
I don't know enough about Scientology, and it's just so fascinating to hear you talk about it, and a lot of it makes sense. I mean, I was brought up listening to just what I hear online or what I've heard in papers or comedy bits about it, like people making fun of John Travolta and Tom Cruise, and the lack of knowledge I have about it, I really can't speak on it. But I at one point I think I even heard that L. Ron Hubbard had said that we were placed here on Earth by aliens.
Well, you know, I don't know if he ever said that in those words, but that's a commonly held belief of people. You know, it's kind of like, I never would have looked at it like, wait, we're here. We're here. You know, we're in present time. We're here.
Yes.
How we got here is a mystery, and exactly how we got here is a mystery. And that's, and of course, that's an oversimplification, even if he said it. But I don't think he ever said those words in that effect. He might have, but, you know. But the thing is there is a lot of information in Scientology that makes sense. If there wasn't, nobody would pay attention to it.
Right.
Nobody would join it. There's also a lot of information that does not make sense. And that was always, and it might make sense to some, and might not make sense to others. It was sort of one's challenge to make sense out of it, if one could. And he called that realm parascientology, just like we have the paranormal. He says there's some things in Scientology that you just can't account for. He called that parascientology.
Huh.
And everybody, and that's really what you're talking about. You talk about the aliens and the fantastic comic book scenarios that, but this gets to another, see, when one digresses onto what the media clings onto, they're very clingy. They cling on to certain ideas.
Sure.
And I just saw on the internet a former Scientologist who was very highly placed, but he came after my time, so to speak, who delineated the belief systems of L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology. And, you know, I would be quick to say it really wasn't a belief system. Because when you have a belief system, you've degenerated the whole subject. And I was not taught to have a belief system. There's a certain amount of, I guess, what you, accoutrements you have to embrace to negotiate any organization or any group of people. But at the foundational core, if you were believing something, you were a sucker. And you were going to be treated as a sucker, not necessarily by Scientology, but by life.
Right.
Because, you know, Scientology is a part of life. You know, and you were involved in that, you could be treated very badly. And this happened to people. Emerson's side was involved. I saw people not act in their own best interest and not necessarily treated by others in the best interest of the person being treated. So, because people are human, they don't always do the right thing. But to get back to this original, to stick to this topic of the realm of viewing, is one would get into a certain realm where one is no longer dealing with the mechanisms in your own mind. You are going into foreign country. Hubbard called it terra incognita, which is the name that they used to call for maps, where the map was the part of the map that was uncharted. Uncharted, rather.
Right.
Say terra incognita means we don't know what that land is. We haven't charted. So Hubbard called those areas of the mind terra incognita. Now, there's certain areas when you go into your own experience, but there's a certain area that he taught, and perhaps not as, I guess, I don't know how to say it. I can't really speak for him. I'm not going to try and speak for him. I can just speak for myself.
Oh, right.
There's an area of the mind where you're not dealing with implants, injuries, psychosomatic incidences, or you're dealing with spirits. You're dealing with other beings. Now, in their upper level, which they call OT3 or Operating Section 3, it deals with the idea of dealing with spirits or beings. And this is a very ridiculed and controversial subject, because the way it is presented in the media is completely ludicrous. And often they're actually quoting directly from what is in the materials. And it is ridiculous.
But it's taken out of context.
Well, it's taken out of a lot of context. And even, in my opinion, Hubbard could have presented it in a much more contextual light and put a lot of maybes and wherefores in there and qualified it so as it was not so disagreeable. And one could still have digested the information and perhaps did it in a much more user-friendly way that was not such an affront to the way that regular human beings think. But I was never interested in how regular human beings think, and I was not necessarily too interested in why he thought the way he did. I just knew that the way he thought he did, he was very sure of himself, and I always figured that he knew more than I did on this topic. And at that time, I would say he did know more on this topic than me.
Right.
I'm a lot smarter and older now, but I used those techniques to great advantage. To great advantage. Because I was able to realize that disincarnate beings occupied my own new sphere, the sphere of my mind, the sphere of my general atmosphere, and I was able to redirect them and vanquish them. And of course, this resulted in a lot more personal happiness for myself, because these were not necessarily things in my own mind, but the powers or forces that could come in and change your mind, influence your mind. And in other words, you're demonstrating your own power in the spiritual plane. And this is what one was supposed to achieve. And it was, the expected result was called, can't even remember it. It had to do with the, you know, return of one's own self-determinism, becomes fully self-determined. And that means you're determining your own life, you're determining your own self. So you can see people that did that level and were never really self-determined because they went on to the next thing in Scientology that was being mistaught, mistold. You know, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and they end up looking like fools to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, to themselves. And people acquiring illnesses, and really, it's a sad story, but if one achieves determinism over one's own life, then who's to say? Who cares what somebody else says?
You know, that's where we all want to be, right?
Yes, and of course, in my case, you know, I could not take the organization seriously after a certain point because it was like the blind leading the blind, and the blind were putting on more and more blinders. Now, that level that I just spoke of, the OT3 or operating Thetan. Of course, Thetan is a spirit in Scientology. They refer to it as a Thetan after the Greek letter Theta, which means life force. So this is an individualized life force. A person is a Thetan. It's a spirit. And different levels of operating Thetan. And this third level, particularly in the 60s, was accompanied with a lot of psychic or spiritual phenomena, certainly for a lot of people that I knew. And Ingo Swann had done this, Pat Price, and this third man who's quite well known. I just can't remember his name. But anyway, they did this level, and I think as time goes by, you might have heard, not Pat Price because he died, but Ingo Swann sort of distanced himself from Scientology and say that he really is never really a Scientologist. Well, you know, I know another side of Ingo, and he was. He was
right.
But then again, just like I distanced myself from it too, because something is only as good as long as it's good for you. And there are a lot of other situations surrounding him that we won't go into that are interesting, but basically, that when that foundation of being able to affect spirits, then you're moving into a realm where you can see. You're moving into a realm of extroverting and actually being able to see things. And that's sort of a precursor to the remote viewing idea that you were talking about. But you see, for from that particular road, there was a lot of work to do. And once you get into that area of a good, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, once you can see the truth of something, then you're dealing with, again, powerful forces. Now, I was mentioning, when I said spiritual entities, I was talking about spiritual entities in my own mind that are affecting me, that, you know, maybe they make it a little harder for me to, you know, go into a certain room or something, or to go into a certain area of town, or to go into a barber shop, or whatever it is.
Right.
But now, when you get into, like, what does somebody want a remote view for? They want to find something of value. They want knowledge. They want to know what the traders on the stock market are saying and thinking. They're going for power. They're going for... It's not going to be too humanitarian in most cases. It's going to attract the greedy.
Right. And control.
Yes. And it's... I read a quote where it says, you know, power attracts psychopaths. It's not the power that's bad. It's what power attracts psychopaths. So if you see what is powerful, it's going to attract psychopaths. If you look at this society, what are the problems in our world? We could delineate them. You could do a whole conspiracy lecture on it, but we can save the time. There's psychopaths connected to power. So then you're dealing with a disease here. And this is why, in my opinion and observation, Scientology didn't work. And people will try and bounce it back on the founder and, you know, point out his own flaws.
Sure.
But it's much more instructive and edifying to look at what was he saying. And what about the power? What about, okay, just take him out of the equation. The problems that he talked about are still the problems. And when you get out to examine the realms of power, it all comes down to power, power, power. And this is actually the subject of a book I'm working on. It may not be ready for quite a while, but it tackles this subject of power and the involvement of L. Ron Hubbard with power, but not so much him and what went wrong with him or what went right with him, but what is this subject really about and how does it affect the individual? Because if you look at the power of the world, this is where we have power. We have lack of distribution of food. We have problems with living in the economy and all this sort of stuff. It's unfair distribution,
right.
Equitable. The equilibrium isn't quite there on the earth. Now, if you want to go into deeper occultism and you go into the deeper history of L. Ron Hubbard and what he was really doing, this goes back to occult experiments he was doing with Jack Parsons in the 1940s, 1946 in particular, called the Babylon Working, where that's a whole subject in itself, the Babylon Working. But what part of what they were doing is they were trying to access the keys of John Dee, the Enochian language of John Dee, the Enochian ethers of John Dee, that John Dee was the magician of Queen Elizabeth I, and he formed with Edward Kelly through, I guess you call it mediumship, the whole angelic language, the Enochian language, which is a language of spells and grammar. When I say grammar, I mean words. It's got its own grammatical syntax and whatnot. It's basically representing the forces that control creation. Now, I'm not saying that language is kosher, and in a broad sense of the word kosher.
Right.
And But basically, he was dealing with world power. John Dee was dealing with world power. L. Ron Hubbard was playing with the chords of world power. And this becomes an issue of interest to anybody studying this subject. So when you go into some of what happened with the remote viewers, they became instruments of this Enochian power, as opposed to anybody, as opposed to really having power themselves. And things can kind of go into the deep end, into the satanic side of life, when certainly the dark side, if not the satanic side.
Right.
So this is what we're dealing with. And people will call Hubbard a Satanist and whatnot, but I didn't find him to be a Satanist at all. But he was somebody who was struggling to exercise certain powers and to bring his philosophy to the world. And did it get mixed up with his own ego? Well, how could it not? But one has to separate oneself from all of this non-productive cogitating over him and his foibles. What is the scape of life, the scope of life? So when you go back to remote viewings, I say, what is the scope of life? Well, it's the scope of life. Everybody's remote viewing every day of their lives. When they go out and they think of, okay, what's my boss going to say on the job? What's he going to say if I, criticize this worker? Well, I want to make sure he's not around because he likes that worker. Whatever it is. What are you going to say to your wife when you come home? Everybody remote views in their own way. They're putting out their feelers, and they're trying, and sometimes you're accurate, and sometimes you're not.
I never looked at it that way. I didn't.
Yes, but it's all about scope.
Yes.
We all have a scope. It's forecasting. Well, people like to go to a gypsy or a gypsy-looking lady with a crystal ball and say, tell me the future. Some of these people have gifts. They have clairvoyance. They can see things. And sometimes we do. Like, yeah, what was it? I remember I was out in San Francisco during the World Series, and I said, yeah, the Giants are going to win 5-0 tonight. I was exactly right.
Oh, wow.
I was exactly right.
That's great.
It was noted. They noted it. But
you could have won some money.
Well, I wasn't doing it to gamble. I just
said,
based upon my very limited knowledge of the San Francisco Giants, I happened to be there and I happened to get a feel. I was not watching the games. I just said, they're going to win 5-0 tonight. Well, I didn't even try and predict the score the next two nights. But we all have our moments.
Right.
We all have our moments. You've heard of woman's intuition.
Yep.
Well, the main thing is, we're all doing this anyway. So we can learn to do things better. And I've written a new book, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing, which goes into how I got involved in all of this time travel research well before I was even working with the people I was working with. And it was a remarkable story, but partly included in that book are exercises that will help one with one's ability to see. It's literally seeing in the dark. So I put exercises in there that will just help one from anybody in their existing state, because I wrote a book which is based upon a dream, and how the dream came true, in a sense. But it also includes very practical exercises and a lot of history, not only history of myself, but with my interactions with the country of Romania, with the country I've been to 8 times.
And those stories are all in The White Bat as well?
Well, I summarized the Romanian adventures in The White Bat.
Oh.
And because I published 5 books concerning Romania: Transylvanian Sunrise, Transylvanian Moonrise.
Yes, those are the ones I've got.
History of Egypt, and Secret Parchment. And the 5th book, The White Bat, is written by me and me alone, because the Radu Sinemar, the Romanian author who wrote the core of those books, I added to them in each case.
Yes.
So it's just, they each say Radu Sinemar with Peter Moon, because I had experiences in Romania that corroborated certain things that he said, and also explored certain things that he said. So, and expressed my own adventures there, and my own unique association with that country comes through a very remarkable Dr. David Anderson, founder of the Time Travel Research Center and the Anderson Institute, both of which are dedicated to technology of time control or time travel. And he will say the reason they call it time control, because you don't really want to say time travel, people will think you're crazy, but it's the same thing.
Right.
So, you know, that's a whole other subject, but basically I was just saying is that some of these, the foundational exercise that will help one clearing one's mind, which is just basically sitting in a dark room, there's a little more to it than that, but going into the peaceful darkness of one's own universe. And many people are afraid to do that. But I'm just mentioning that book, not only to advertise the book, but because it fits in, because it takes you right where you're sitting now.
So basically your latest book would be a good starting point into all of your books, actually.
It could be, and I always try to write every book that I write, so because inevitably it's going to be picked up by somebody who's never heard of me.
Sure.
And this is... So I have to start from square one. And I also, and that book was picked up by somebody who read it for writing. They wanted to learn how to write or sharpen their writing skills. And it so happened that all the paranormal stuff that's written about there, they could totally correlate. It was totally right where they were sitting, but they read it for the purpose of writing. And it helped them. But because it does teach you how to write as well. It teaches you how to write. Not so much, I'm not teaching grammar lessons.
Yeah.
I'll tell you to go out and study a grammar book, on a junior high school grammar book, if you need to.
Right.
But I'm not there to teach grammar. But, you know, you read the components and of how to do something, but it gives you a guide on how to write, how to do your art, because you're basically mixing both sides of the brain, the left brain and the right brain. And that's a whole key secret teaching of the integration of the two sides of the brain.
Right. Okay.
They called it the school of the left eye of Horus and the school of the right eye of Horus, representing the two hemispheres of the brain and the integration of which. So, which goes into deeper mysteries yet still. But it basically comes down to, we can start with basics.
Well, Peter, that wraps up our time for today. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, yes. Yes, because obviously we just begin to touch on this subject of remote viewing. And in the next podcast, we can go into some of the deeper and more fundamental elements of what is at stake here and what is really going on, and how individuals can use this to their advantage or disadvantage. So I'll look forward to talking to you again for part two.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com. And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.